You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
I'm in this interesting space where my viewers are mostly white, but they're having this moment where it's like, oh, okay, she's black. Like, we are talking about black issues now.
Welcome to a new episode of Black Tea. Today, we're really excited to be talking to a Canadian broadcasting icon, Tracy Moore. And we really get into it with Tracy in this interview. We talk about her experience going to the University of Western Ontario as a grad student coming from McGill, and just, you know, a lot of her broadcasting dreams and her boss moves that she makes in her business, and just, you know, drops a lot of gems. So we're really excited about that. But one of the things that I actually liked, Alton, about our discussion with Tracy was about Western, because I've always had a fascination with London, Ontario, because I lived there for a year after high school. I tried to go to Western, but I just faced so much racism. I had to come back home and go to York. So to just kind of see how things have unfolded with Western, just different news items, you know, racism, Islamophobia, just different hate crimes on campus, sexual assault. It blows my mind, because not only did I live there, but like, we all have stories. We all know people that went to Western. So I don't know if you had friends and stuff like that who talked about it, or you went to the sports weekend or whatever, but I feel like we all have this connection, and it's kind of been like an open secret. And as painful as it can be, I like the fact we're actually talking about, you know, some of the more negative aspects of living in London.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of our former guests, you know, on Black Tea, the Grammy Award nominated musician Lito Pimienta. And, you know, she had been sharing some pretty horrific tales tied to, you know, essentially her family arriving in London, Ontario, you know, from Colombia, Latin America, yep. and just not having the best time. And she always tells a story about arriving in London, and then, you know, I think she was on her way to take a bus, and a guy looked at her, blew a cigarette in her face, and said, you know, go back to your country, right? So that's her story. Wow. She always tells. So that was her welcoming to London, you know? So clearly there's some issues that need to be unpacked as far as, you know, Western, University of Western Ontario in particular, London, Ontario in general.
Absolutely. And that's what, you know, the show's here for. I'm grateful for it. I can't say that I'm trying to step foot in London anytime soon, but I certainly want it to be safe and a good environment for everybody. So when we come back is the interview with Tracy.
Tracy is a Canadian television journalist and host of the beloved lifestyle magazine show Cityline on City, and she's been there since 2008. And Tracy actually previously served as a news anchor on City TV's Toronto's Breakfast Television between 2005-2008. And there's just a laundry list of accolades that Tracy has accumulated over this time. I mean, she's been on Hello Magazine's Most Beautiful list. She's carried the torch for the Pan Am Games. She's thrown out the first pitch at a Toronto Blue Jays game. She's hosted the live Grammys red carpet show. And twice a year, she even designs her own fashion line, which is Tracy Moore by Fridas. You all need to know this. She's a force of nature on social media, all right? This is where a lot of people engage with Tracy. She boasts, you know, almost 150,000 followers on Instagram. And Tracy's a bit of a, I guess, an influencer, dare I say it. So Tracy, what I want to ask you, it's actually your 16th year working at Rogers Media. You're like an OG, you're a seasoned vet. How does it feel?
It's so weird. It's so weird thinking of myself as a veteran, because I still remember being out there as a videographer at CBC, trying to understand why the other reporters were like alienating me at the scrums. Like, how do I get the information? How do I do this? Where do I go? The whole game is very cliquey, I find. Media is very cliquey. And so I always think of myself as that cub reporter trying to sort of learn the system and navigate and break her way through. It's really weird to see all these young people now coming up and saying, I watched you when I was a little girl. Like, oh my God, I feel so old. But it also feels so good. Like, it's really nice to be at this place in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to kind of bring it back to your humble beginnings. I know that you are on the cover of the upcoming Northwestern Alumni Magazine. Mm-hmm. So you got your master's, I believe it was Master's of Journalism at Western. And I went to Western for a year as well. It was kind of an isolating experience. And I feel like Western's kind of like ground zero for sort of experiencing some of the isolation, racial microaggressions, like a lot of the things that have come out about London in the past few years. A lot of it has kind of emerged from Western. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if you could talk about your experiences there and if you kind of ran home after or if you wanted to stay there.
I ran so hard home. Like, this was the situation for me. I had done 4 years at McGill in Montreal, and my communities in Montreal were a lot of French, West Indian, Haitians, a lot of Africans, a lot of African Canadians. That was sort of our nucleus. And then we're in Montreal. So we are partying hard. I remember at the end of the 4 years, the DJs and promoters were like, "You were getting a degree?" Like, "Oh yeah, I'm here for school, man." We partied. We learned. We got up early. We did our lectures. We protested. Like, it's a very vibrant counterculture there as well. I loved Montreal. So I'm in this situation where after my 4 years, I'm done. And I actually want to stick around another year. And my parents are like, "Well, you're cut off." So I got a job and I stayed there for another year. And I realized, okay, I got to figure out what I'm going to do. I had done the campus radio station in Montreal. And so I got sort of this little bug in my ear about broadcast. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do that. So I applied to Columbia and I applied to Western because they were both 1 year master's programs. And I wanted to get in and out and get my career started. I got on the waiting list for Columbia, and Western was starting their program in May. I would have had to wait until like about August to hear back from Columbia. So I went for it. I went to Western. And it was like night and day. And the thing that was, I guess, the most shocking for me about Western was I'm good about finding community. I'm not shy. I met most of my friends in Montreal by walking right up to them and, you know, just saying, "What's up?" So I get to London and I feel that I'm trying to figure out how, like, who my community is going to be there. I'm the only Black person in the master's program, not a surprise at all. And when I reach out to the Caribbean community there, they're very rich foreign students. And I didn't fit into that clique at all because I had no money. I was in the minuses. I was on loan. I'm like walking to school. I'm not even in one of the cute neighborhoods in London because I can't afford that. There was no place for me to land. And while I made some really good girlfriends within the program, they did not understand my experience at all. I was called the N-bomb. I was isolated at the bars. I felt like people didn't understand who I was, my hair, what it was about, like nothing about me. I love the people in my program and I love my profs, but the feeling there was incredibly isolating. And I've actually felt myself slipping into depression a few times. And my girlfriends would come to Toronto and they would come with some booze and they would hang out with me and then they'd leave and I would be stuck there. It was a great year for my education, but it was a terrible year for my mental health. And when I was done, I never went back. Like even when we're driving through maybe to Windsor and I've got to look at the London signs, like I get a shiver. And I feel bad saying that for the people who live in London, because I'm sure there's a community there for them. There just was not one for me.
Right, right. Now, I noticed that you appear to be quite, very savvy entrepreneur, you know? Like I can't exactly say that I've seen too many Canadian television hosts, designing their own fashion line and then making it available, like on the Home Shopping Network, for example, as I see your line, Tracy Moore by Frida's, like... Can you talk to us a little bit about that fashion line and then just how you view entrepreneurship in general?
You know, I feel like I need to give credit where it's due. I actually am pretty good at making money, but I feel that my husband is very good at ideas. Leo was the one that hyped me up when I had this opportunity to do Cityline. That was not within my, like, I wasn't thinking lifestyle. I did journalism. I'm like, I'm going to be in a war-torn country. I'm going to be looking at wealth disparity. I'm going to be in developing nations. And when Cityline came around, he immediately said to me, "Hold on a second. If you get out of news, there's this world of opportunities. There is sponsorship opportunities. There's brand engagements you can do." And I was like, oh. And so that whole, like, he got me hype about this whole lifestyle situation. And I went into auditions thinking, okay, this is a really good potential for us to build on the $2 we have right now. So let's see what we can do with that. So when I started working on CityLine, and you would look through the viewer emails, because at that point it was viewer emails, it wasn't so much social media. It didn't matter what I was discussing on the show. It didn't matter what we had cooked. It didn't matter what the lessons were. They just wanted to know what I was wearing. Where'd the shirt come from? Where's the skirt from? And every once in a while, like, where's the lipstick from? So from year one, Leo started saying, if you're going to keep telling people where the clothing is from, it should be from Tracy Moore. They all want to know where the blouse is from. Make a blouse and wear it every day on the show. And I was like, well, I feel like I have to be bigger, and I've got to bide my time and earn my respect and all of this stuff. And so it was about 6 years in when I said, okay, fine, I will approach my clothing sponsor and I will see how they feel about potentially working with me on this. Because my whole thing is, broadcast is fleeting. You know, we are basically like furniture. They can come in one day and decide they want to change the sofa and put in a new host whenever they want. So I approached my clothing sponsors, and Rogers owns TSC. And so there was already interest at TSC for me to be fronting one of their brands. And I didn't want to front one of their brands. I thought, if I'm going to be on TSC, I need it to be my label. So I went to Frida's and I said, how do you all feel about doing a line with me? And they were like, that would be great. And I said, how do you feel about working on TSC? And they said, absolutely not. They said, that will dilute our brand. We're not about direct sales. That's not what we do. We're high end. We're boutique. And I said, okay, how would you feel about being a silent partner? And they said, we would totally do that. And I get graphics done. I get the storyline done. I go back to Frida's. I said, okay, here's the label. This is what I'm going to want on the labels. And they're like, well, where's our name? And I said, but you guys wanted to be silent partners. Remember, TSC will dilute your brand. They're like, oh, no, we want in on this. So I'm like, okay. So we changed the label to Tracy Moore Designed by Frida's, and off we went. And I learned so much about this industry, how fickle it is. The volume is small in Canada. Like, it's really, the units they're buying are not a lot of units. I learned about the hits you have to take if you're making a line that includes plus sizes. You know, people don't like making plus sizes for a reason. They don't think they're going to sell. They're more material, but I was really insistent that we at least go up to a size 20. So all of these things I learned along the way, and I learned about promotion, and I learned about marketing. And it's been a lot of work, I find, for not a ton of money, but it's been nice for me to lean in the direction of doing something I don't know. And for me, I don't know if it's like this for you, Dalton, but for me, when it comes to entrepreneurship, I actually like the process of getting uncomfortable and learning about things that I didn't know anything about in school. I have not been exposed to. No one in my family is an entrepreneur. So this has been, it's been a pretty cool journey for me.
Yeah, I love that process. It's just a trial and error, and then working out commissions, you know, like, I don't know if hubby Leo is getting some big commissions on these deals, on these, and I'm joking.
We see it as my money is his money and his money is my money. Like, honestly, he's very good with the future planning and I am not, but I can make the money.
Well, it's great that the show gave you like the possibility and like opening up your mind to that. But speaking about the show and the lifestyle space, because I know that you said that, you know, your background's in news, and the lifestyle space, I guess, wasn't typically thought of as something, you know, so serious, where you're really doing like hard-hitting, tough conversations. But that's sort of something that I've noticed you've pivoted to, especially in the last year. You have the CityLine podcast on race. You've been opening up, you know, about anti-Black racism. How has that been, opening up that dialogue in the lifestyle space?
It's been an interesting journey, because when I started 13 years ago, there was a major diversity gap on the show, which was glaringly obvious to me. And I always knew in the back of my mind that I really wanted to be able to figure out how to do the job, and at the same time, how to open this up, because the Canadians that the show were appealing to were not even the Canadians that I necessarily had in my family or in my friend group. So how do we make this show relevant to the people that have raised me and grown me and, you know, my aunts and uncles and this whole, like, how do we make it relevant to them? How do we make Black women feel that they can come on here for a makeover when there is not one hairstylist that can deal with natural hair? Like, how does that transition happen? So all these things were on the radar for me right away in 2008. But I also feel that I had to Obama it. It wasn't going to be me coming in two guns a-blazing. It was going to be, let me learn the lay of the land. And let me also treat these people that are doing this legacy show with mad respect, because the work that they do is incredible. Hosts will come and go on this show, but the show will continue. So we got in a few years and I saw experts that I felt that I really wanted to be on the show who were diverse, and they would get on the show and then they weren't really getting booked a lot. And so that was my weekly, daily fight, trying to figure out and navigate in, you know, a non-bullish way. Like, how do I get these people on? How do we get these topics covered? So it has been a process. And we've had regime changes and we've had a boss come in that was more sympathetic to what I was trying to do in terms of diversity. And then a boss coming in saying, why are we so behind? I was like, finally, okay, good. Why are we so behind? So many women of color come in as interns. I don't see any of them getting hired. So let's not make the excuse that we don't see the people. The people are coming in the door and we're letting them go. So what can we do to fix things? So this is a conversation that has been happening for many, many years. And I have dealt with topics to do with race. We've talked about gender pronouns. We've had a lot of serious conversations on CityLine before 2020. And then 2020 came around and, like, it was a volcano. And being a Black woman who's very vocal about race and, you know, gender issues on social media, and being the host on this show, all of a sudden, I'm in this interesting space where my viewers are mostly white, but they're having this moment where it's like, oh, okay, she's Black. Like, we are talking about Black issues now. I definitely saw it as my role, and I take it on as my role to help to educate and maybe build awareness about these things, about these topics, everything from digital blackface to misogynoir to being Black in the media. We've had a lot of in-depth conversations. What I started to find, though, in the summer of 2020 was that the programming that I really, really desperately wanted on the show was now happening, and now I was being triggered by the content, which was something I wasn't expecting. So there was one day we did a story about the six Asian women that were killed in Atlanta. And I could barely get through the conversation. You know, I had to end up getting a therapist. I had a panic attack on set. So there was a lot going on. And I feel like there's been a very heavy price to pay for being in this space at this time. But I also feel like I don't know if there's really any other way to do it. It would be insane for me to not discuss what's happening globally and nationally when it comes to race and the racial reckoning all of a sudden we're all seeing. So it's been messy, but it's been necessary. When I got to this year, 2021, things relaxed a little bit. And it's been a little bit easier and it's been a little bit lighter. So things are definitely getting better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's nice to hear. I mean, yeah, I mean, people even perhaps posting less Black squares and, you know, that's a whole other show. But, you know, race matters. I want to talk a bit about social media. So even on your socials, I mean, I get the sense that you quite enjoy actually letting your viewers into your day-to-day life. So of course, we have to shout out the kids because we see them on your socials all the time, right? Sydney, Eva, yeah. Your dog, Ozzy, like makes all these special guest appearances. You know what I'm saying? and Leo. So real talk, like with your husband, kids, you know, Ozzy's a dog, so he can't say much, but he can bark. Do they ever like kind of say sometimes like, you know, like Trace, like, I want nothing to do with Instagram today, or do they do the opposite? Like they want to be all up in your feed, or do they lap it up? Like, you know what I mean? Like what's going on there?
Listen, I think we're all realists, and I think that we're raising two very realistic children, and Instagram can be okay, but some days I want to throw it in the bin. Mm-hmm. Like I don't even want to be a part of social media. Like it's gross. So social media for me is something that it is relevant for me to be a part of for the career that I have and also for the brand deals that I can have. I feel if I did not have those brand deals and if there, you know, maybe wasn't pressure from just my industry to be a part of it, I think I'd get off. But it's turned out that it is incredibly lucrative. I don't do a ton of influencing deals, but I try and do deals with companies that I really believe in, companies that really want to invest in me, companies that really see value in what I do. Writing is incredibly easy for me. And I, you know, I enjoy sort of putting together a story. So all these things work with me. It's an easy platform to be a part of. The mental health side of it, I don't think it's a healthy thing to do. I really don't. I think that it is a realistic and smart move for me to be a part of social media. In terms of the kids, Sydney, that's my son. He is the one that is annoyed by photos the most, I would say. Like I'll see him immediately if I pull up my camera and he, like there are times when he will just immediately close up and I'm like, okay, Sid, you don't want to be in the picture. You don't want me to take the picture. He's like, not now. Like, I don't want you to take the picture now. I'm like, okay, I'm putting it away. And he has the right to let me know if that picture of his cute new hairstyle can be on my Instagram or not. And some days he's super enthusiastic about it. Other days he's like, nah. And I have to respect that because they have to build their own stories. Leo got wise to the game super quick. I think he went from, this is annoying, I don't want to take photos of your outfit, to, oh, you can make money? Give me the camera. So he's on board. Yeah. He's on board. He's a realist like me. And if we can accomplish some financial goals and at the same time give me an avenue and an opportunity to engage people and at the same time show folks that Black people can live in healthy spaces and love each other, and we can be affectionate, and we can be dog owners, and we can camp, and we can play hockey. Like, if we can do all those things with this platform that is sometimes total trash, let's be a part of it.
I find that you're so authentic on social media. You really don't hold anything back. Mm-hmm. And I really love like how your social media posts are full of anecdotes and life lessons. So I just wanted to know, like, when did you figure out that authenticity was going to be such a big part of your work?
Part of it came from CityLine, to be honest with you, because I was trying to fit who I was into this image of a lifestyle host, and it wasn't really working because I'm never going to cook. I'm never going to like it. I don't like it. I want to eat. I don't want to cook. And I'd be doing the segments, and it's like, I don't do any of this stuff at home. So why don't I just be honest about that? So I started being honest about it. And I'd be honest about the fact, yeah, I'm wearing Spanx. Like I have to. I feel like I've got belly overhang and I don't feel comfortable in this tight dress without it. And the more I was honest, even if the viewers didn't necessarily agree, like you never cook, they didn't care because at least I was being honest about who I was. I find if you start going down that road of pretending to be something you're not, you start to make life really hard for yourself because people are going to catch you. All I put on my page, it has happened. It is either currently happening or it has happened or it will happen. It's all based on real life. And I think it's a way easier way to live. And people will judge you and critique you for the mistakes you made, but that's okay. They're my mistakes. They're who I am.
Now, here's the thing. Working on a top-rated television show, CityLine, and then, you know, engaging all of these other business interests, that obviously takes time. And, you know, last time I checked, there's only 24 hours in a day, right? So how do you juggle, you know, your work and home life as far as, you know, social media, the fashion lines, other, you know, I'm sure you do speaking engagements, the show, like how do you maintain that balance at the end of the day?
Well, this week, if I had to look at how I've handled the balance, it has not gone well. Yesterday was one of those days where I was like, how could I have done this better? And the answer was there was no way to do it better. I don't believe in balance. I don't have balance in my life. And I reconciled myself with that ages ago. Yesterday was one of those days where the show went longer than it usually does. And then I had two meetings afterwards. I quickly called the producer for this show just to ask some questions about the tech. At the same time, my kids were coming home from their first day of school and really wanted to talk to me about it. But an Uber was pulling up to take me to an event that I was hosting for the Children's Aid Foundation. And while I was at that Children's Aid Foundation event, when I was in my green room, I was working on a future social media post that had to be done. So I got home at, 8:30, 9 o'clock, and the kids are disappointed, and I haven't said two words to Leo, and I'm starving, and that's just my life. Most days are not like that, but in terms of striving for any semblance of perfection or balance, I don't do it. So Dalton, I'm just trying to get things done when I can get done, and I'm also putting a big priority on joy and fun and rest. So I try and throw in as much of all of those things as I can and see where it all lands. That's my answer.
Wow, you're doing a great job.
Yeah,
thank you. You're doing a fantastic job.
I'm trying. I'm happy. And I think that's the important thing. Like, I always compare my life to a sandwich. Like, you can have a really neat, the neat club sandwich, and it's cut perfectly on the bias and everything's perfect. But my life is like, the bacon's falling out and the mayo's all over the plate and you're dipping the sandwich in the mayo and you got some avocado on your face, but it's good. Like, it tastes amazing. So my life is the messy version and I'm cool with it.
Yeah, totally. So Tracy, listen, it was a real pleasure and an honor chatting. Keep shining.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Listen, I feel so supported, and that to me is more important than any kind of accolade out there. Like, I feel supported. I feel supported by you, Milena. I feel supported by you, Dalton. I feel supported by the community. And to me, that will always be worth the most. So thanks for having me stop by.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have now reached the tea segment, and Dalton has something to talk about. It's a TV topic, and I love TV. Anybody that knows me knows that due to my attention span and my brain, I'm not a movie person. I'm all about TV. I'm one of those people that just keeps watching the same shows over and over again and loves to dive into new ones. So what do you have to talk about today, Dalton?
Yeah, there's this interesting television show that's out now. I've been watching a couple episodes and, it's called Our Kind of People. And before I get into it, I have to shout out the late Lawrence Otis Graham. Now, he had passed away early this year and I didn't even hear about it, maybe because I'm here in Canada, but Graham was this iconic corporate lawyer, real estate attorney, and he was a New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of books. I think it's like 14 nonfiction books. Some of them focused on class in America, right? Now, the reason I mention this is because he wrote this book called Our Kind of People, Inside America's Black Upper Class, and it was adapted into this interesting new television series based on the book, and it just began airing on Fox. So the thing is, Mel, when I started thinking about the America's Black Upper Class or Canada's Black Upper Class, it reminded me of Spike Lee. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm a huge Spike Lee fan. And I just remember reading years ago that Spike, despite all of his success and amazing movies, Do the Right Thing and Mo Betta Blues, he's made a ton of money. But his wife, Tanya Lee Lewis, she's the moneyed person in the family because she comes from what they call old money. Tanya Lee Lewis, she actually wrote a best-selling book called Gotham Diaries, and it sort of outlines how this old money black society that she occupies exists, and there's a bunch of clubs and community members that are tied to these kind of almost secret societies, in America. So what's your take on this, Mel? As far as this idea of old money, old black money,
First of all, I love when women have more money than men in any situation, whether they're married, single, estranged, anything. So I think that's awesome. Awesome. And I actually didn't know of the background of the show or anything really about the show until I found out about the fact Lee Daniels was attached to the project. And I love Lee Daniels. But in terms of stories about black wealth, I think it's just this thing about we got to be telling more than a singular story. Yes, we are not in a position where we're the wealthiest ethnic group of people on earth. I understand that there is, you know, a decent amount of Black wealth on this earth. There's also arguments to be made in terms of the corruption of that and what sacrifices had to be made, you know, dating back hundreds of years. So I'm not here to excuse that. But I also think there's a lot of wealthy Black people that exist, especially in the United States. Like, I know this show is based in a fictional town, but you hear stories about this. I mean, you hear stories about people that go to historically Black colleges and their family's money goes back generations. You hear stories about royalty in many African countries. Like, there's just different stories to tell. My whole thing about Black storytelling is that you don't have to like it all. We just have to celebrate all of it. I mean, to me, that's what Black excellence is, having the opportunity to do whatever you want, tell whatever story you want. And I think that people like, I mean, I know we talked about it last season, but Tyler Perry, Lee Daniels, they're good at that, you know? Yeah. So keep them coming. But I really want to start watching it, first of all, because it seems extremely juicy. And I like, you know, gossip. And I know that he did Empire, which was one of my favorite shows before it got bad. So I think it's good.
I totally agree with your position. It's kind of like, Mel, you know, we're not this sort of monolithic, homogenous, you know, glob of humanity. And I think, you know, that's why I'm sort of referencing even Spike Lee, because like, despite all his wealth and success, by his wife's standards, he's pretty much considered working class. You know what I mean? From a class positioning standpoint.
Oh, right. And, yeah. And it's so funny. It's Spike Lee. He's a legend.
Yeah, and a wealthy legend, but he's kind of broke this versus his wife, who's like old money. You know what I mean? Like, let me give it to you this way. Spike Lee's wife, you know, her father, George Lewis, he's a really popular exec. Like, he was like the highest ranking Black executive at Philip Morris. He's on the he was on the cover of Fortune magazine, and he's a member of this club. It's called the Boulez, right? So the Boulez, it's the most elite social club for Black men in America. And, you know, people like, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, they were members of this same elite Black social club called the Boulez. And her mother is a member of the Lynx, which is a similar group. You know, it's this elite social club for Black women with an all-female membership. So, you know, I think the idea here is if there are people out there who have in their mind some caricature of all or most Black people growing up in the quote-unquote hood, this show might give them a stroke, you know what I mean? Because it's showing a side of the community that the media aren't interested in seeing or showing much of.
Right. Well, I actually think that the media and the people that are the are gatekeeping what people see about Black people are the ones that upset. Like, it's not ones that would be upset, sorry. It's not us. It's the people that want to control how we're seen. And sometimes it's us, but a lot of the time it's not, because we don't control the media. I think we should, but we don't.
Yeah. You know, I'm attached to this Black fatherhood group, and I remember a crew coming in from a major broadcaster, and they were so obsessed and fixated on sort of shooting some of the more challenging aspects of our community. But, you know, it was interesting to see the final cut of the little documentary piece they did, because a lot of the dads in the group that I'm in, like, they're solidly middle class, you know, they're super well educated, you know, like many of them have master's degree. No, I'm just being honest with you, right? They own, you know, they're homeowners. But this broadcaster that came in that shall remain nameless, like the end result was sort of focused on this sort of hood narrative and growing up in the hood. Mm. And it's just like, yeah, so the members of our group, we couldn't relate to it.
Which is an important story to tell too, yeah.
Yeah, no, like, it exists, but that's all you see though. Yeah. You just don't see that. That's even with this show is that, no, they're showing, they're saying, hey, no, there are a lot of, you know, Black wealthy people from old money. You know, it's not just, we're not all from the hood, you mean? Like,
no, 100%. Yeah. And I also want to point out, I just looked it up. The show takes place in or near Martha's Vineyard. But what I thought was interesting is that's where Obama had his super spreader 60th birthday party, where he ended up, you know, reducing the guest list when it got leaked to the media. So he basically like told all his staff that they can't come to his party and only kept A-list celebrities. That's allegedly. Like, it's just so interesting to me because the pinnacle of Black excellence and Black wealth was also on Martha's Vineyard having a super spreader birthday party. So shout out to Obama.
That's right.
And if you keep listening to the podcast, you'll find out how I feel about Obama. Stay tuned for that.
And if our podcast, you know, takes off in the way we expect it will,
right,
we may be spending summers in Martha's Vineyard and Sag Harbor.
Yeah.
Holla.
Yeah, we'll just pretend we never said that if we ever see him.
That's right. Yeah. So that's it. Anyways, you know, this life that they document in the show and in some of Lawrence Otis Graham's literature, it's just amazing. You know, it's like, you know, cotillion balls, multi-million dollar homes.
Oh, my God.
Summers. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting show. Sag Harbor, you know. So, yeah. So tune in. I'm imploring our listenership to tune in because it's showing a different slice of Black life that is rarely, if ever, seen, you know, on network television. So that's my recommendation.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Black Tea. We'd like to give a shout out to our super producer, Kevin Sexton, Ryan Clark, who does our sound mixing, and our showrunner, Claire Broussard.